Hey, good morning, everybody. My name's Luther P. I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict. Hey, my friend, my good friend Barry, here this morning. I say my good friend. Me and Barry, we've been to Ghana and Senegal. We've been around. They try to assassinate us. Oh, yeah. Yeah, out of the country and the whole deal, man. But this is why I went to the meditation this morning. And matter of fact, my good friend Donald asked me, says, you prayed up? And I went to the meditation this morning, and I told him I was, and then I'm going to share this with you. This is how I wake up every morning. And I started this recently with me and my girl. And when I get up in the morning, I have her read this to me, because she loves to take care of me. Well, I got a good one. I'm telling you, I take care of her too, you know. And this is from a book called Jesus Calling. January 4th. Let me bless you with my grace and peace. Open your heart and mind to receive all that I have for you. Do not be ashamed of your emptiness. Instead, view it as the optimal condition for being filled with my peace. It is easy to touch up your outward appearance, to look as if you have it all together. Your attempts to look good can fool most people, but I see straight through you into the depths of your being. There is no place for pretense in your relationship with me. Rejoice in the relief of being fully understood. Talk to me about your struggles and feelings of inadequacy. Little by little, I will transform your weaknesses into strength. Remember that your relationship with me is saturated in grace. Therefore, nothing, and I mean nothing that you can do or don't do, can separate you from my presence. I'm fortunate. I'm fortunate because in San Francisco, where I'm from, the Fillmore District, used to live right up the street from Bop City. A lot of you old jazz folks may have heard about the Harlem of the West. You know, Cal Jada and Miles Davis and all of them came there. I'm an RBC, a Roman Black Catholic. And my mother said that the family that prays together stays together. It's a real strong woman. My mama had six kids after she was 35 years old. She said, I was old when I had y'all. And I'm the number one son. And my mother came home one day, and she put a prayer right in between the Our Father and Hail Mary. And the prayer went, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Well, I didn't know it, but my mother had went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that day, in 1955, to an Al-Anon meeting. My father was an alcoholic, and she didn't know what to do, and she read an article by a guy named Jack Alexander in the Saturday Post. I saw it on the calendar, in the AA calendars they have back there. And she found out about AA, and she went and she bought that home. And she put it right in between Our Father and Hail Mary. Boy, I used that prayer. I used to think it was a Catholic prayer. I used that prayer in so many places. I mean, you know, when they was going to kill me, when I was going to kill them, when I was scared and hungry and all that, I used that. And marched on up the road with it. And in my day when I came up, my mother told us one thing that night. You know, old folks, they really didn't have a lot to say. And she said, I want to tell you one thing. So you can't drink like other people. So just like a kid, you know, it went out one ear and out the other. And we went on and grew up. And we moved up the street to the OC Projects. And right on the corner, 80 and Laguna. And OC stands for out of control. So me and my partners, me and the guy was in a gang called the Mighty Midgets, those short guys. And, you know, we were 12, 13 years old, you know. And when I come up, they had what they call rock gut. But alcohol was so cool. They had a song about it. You guys would have to be 70 and over, really. But you may have heard it, but I don't sing it too much. And it goes, W-P-L-J, it really tastes good to me. Oh, W-P-L-J, it really tastes good to me. Oh, well, the good, good wine really make you feel so fine. And that W-P is for white port and lemon juice. So me and my friend, we'd be somewhere, and we'd look at one another, and we'd elbow on the shelf. We'd say, let's go bail Shorty off the shelf. That was our little key word. Because when I grew up, they called them little punch short dogs. We'd go on down to Sullivan's Liquor Store, and we'd look around, stand around. And they had the rod gut in the back, in the corner, underneath everything else. You know, the white and red ripple, you know what I mean, all the thing. That's what a white port was. And one of us would go and we would get a little thing of lemon juice, and the other one would go back there and we'd steal the white port, and we'd come out, and we'd get out, we wouldn't even go around the corner, and I'd be saying, first, I was alcoholic and immediately, first! Yeah, and he turned that same wine bottle that I used to shoot heroin and everything else laid on, we'd turn it, and you'd have to drink about that much off the top. And that was called killing the poison.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, I drink my shit, pour that lemon juice in, and shake it on up, and then we get on to the party. You know, we'd be down there, the music would come up. Please return your love to me. Oh, boy, man, you beat me to the punch. You know, they said, get out of the way and let Luther dance. You know, boy, we could dance, you know. And all my friends, these guys, you know, they was going to jail. They was going to California Youth Authority and stuff. I wasn't. Knew I had a very high IQ and I loved the girls. I had a little Romeo on my club jacket. I had a baby when I was 15. I got 9 kids, 7 girls and 2 boys, and my oldest daughter's 55. My youngest is 27. So my friends were gone. They disappeared. I didn't know where they'd go, Naples. It was cool, and we kept drinking, singing in the shower, and all those things. 15 years old, my grandmother got sick, and my mama said, well, I'm going to move down to where my mother is. We moved down to a place called Palo Alto. And down in Palo Alto, nice homes and stuff. And we got down there, and it was a culture shock to me. Not only because it was an all-white area, but they was going to A&W, root beer to hang out at nighttime. They were drinking country club liquor. They was wearing pig pants and white socks, and they were singing the Beach Boys. And I said, well, what is going on down here? Because it wasn't about the color of the people's skin, because my mother told me the color of a man's skin is in his heart. And my mother's skin was white. They used to see her with all those little black kids and say, what are you doing with all them little black kids? You know, she had a pigment of the skin. And right in the Fillmore district, we had the Russian Orthodox was right there. The Mission district is next door, and in San Francisco, it ain't about none of that. You're in the city, you know, and you're having a good time. But I couldn't drink no more. I didn't have my friends. And I used to hitchhike back up to San Francisco until I found that guy at my school that liked to drink like I did. I don't know how I found him. That guy was named Ron. They called him Pigpen. And years later, he became the leader of the Grateful Dead. And me and Pigpen would meet on the corner right at the school. And we'd have a bottle of wine, and we'd chug a little of that wine, and we'd go to school. You know, and it was fine. You know, and it was okay to stay down there then. Well, at 16 years old, I decided that I wanted to be a man. I wanted to join the United States Marine Corps. I seen that thing, you know, be a man, M-A-N, man. I went home and told my mother and father, I said, I want to go in the Marine Corps. I was having a little problem in school. No, it wasn't no big thing, you know. And they said, okay. I asked my mother years later, what did she feel when her number one son came home to ask that? And they signed for me, and the day I was 17 years old, I went to the United States Marine Corps. And I went through boot camp, and you know, when you finish boot camp, you go to the bar. They got them right on the base. So it was going down, you know. And they sent me to school. You know, I finished school. They put me in a helicopter unit. And the next thing I know, we was on the way to Vietnam. And so when I was on the boat, I found the guys that had the liquor, because you know you're not supposed to have none on the boat, guys in the Navy. In the Marine Corps is part of the United States Navy. They take us to Vietnam. And years later, I got a chance to look back on that stuff, and I look back and we get ready to fly off into to combat Operation Silver Star. And they, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, they give us steak and eggs. I said, well, they sure is feeding us good. You know, I didn't know that was a traditional meal before they send you to combat. And we ate steak and eggs, and we got up in them helicopters, and we flew in into live fire. And that's where it was, you know. And when we got in there, we found out that the French had been there before us, you know. And they had the cognac and beer and stuff, and it was, boy, I'm telling you. And stuff started to happen then, you know. I would get that alcohol, the beer, and the cognac, and the helicopter be ready. Oh, where you going? I'm going with you. Because we had gotten overran, and we didn't have our rifles with us. And it was on Thanksgiving Day, and it wasn't pretty. And so after that, I had my rifle with me and my 45. When you're in a helicopter, you get a 45 every day. They used to make fun of me. They were getting ready to go out on the mission, the search and destroy, the technical area responsibility with the helicopter. Wait, where are you going? Let me in. No, I'm going. Because it was, boy, they had 50 caliber machine guns on the doors. They had rocket pods underneath, you know. You had big million candle power light. And the gunner and the co-gunner, they got, everybody got machine guns and stuff. Don't leave me, not here. And we gone off and boom, we come back and all the things that happened. And I came back to the United States. I spent a year, 2 months and 5 days, and I came back to the United States of America. And people were burning up drive cards and whatever they were doing. And there was a place that had a liquor store, the only place I ever seen in the world. Got two liquor stores right next door to each other. One's there, one's here. I ain't never seen nothing like it in my life. A1 and Charlie's. And I got me a credit account at both of them. And got me, yo, I mean, I'm Marine Corps. I got some money now, you know. And I went by, where my partner, where Pig at? They said, well, Pig's up in San Francisco at 8 Ashbury. They just made it big and stuff, you know. I go over to, I see his brother. He gave me the phone on Pig Pen and said, come up here, man. I came on up to Heaton Ashbury, you know, sit down on the corner, drinking that Valley High with him, and I stayed up there for 23 years in the disease. And some people saw me and said, well, you know what? This guy ain't scared. He carrying a pistol all the time. We're going to take it with us. And so they had me with them, driving around their laboratories, doing the things that they did. And I seen a guy make $10,000. I said, I want that, so I'm going to teach you how to do this. And it's just like if you're an alcoholic, somebody give you a liquor store, well, I had that, and so I was involved in the manufacture and sale of the drug that I liked. And I went on, and it got bad. You know, I mean, it was a lot of music, a lot of free love and sex and stuff, but it got bad. And several years after I got back, in 1970, I got accused of a first-degree murder, death penalty. And they all of a sudden give me the death penalty. So I did 19 months in a single cell. And I was the first black man in San Mateo County to be found not guilty of a first degree murder. And before I could get to my sister's house, when I got my life back, I had me some dope, I had me some alcohol, and I had me a pistol. And I just continued doing what I do until 1975. I got convicted of manslaughter and sent to prison. And you know, I went in and I came out and I did all the things that we do in all the darkness and the places where we are, you know. And in 1980, I got convicted of a murder and I got life. And so when I got to prison, all my partners was there. The guys from the Aryan Brotherhood, the Mexican Mafia, the Black Gorilla Family, Coco County White Boys. These is all folks that I had manufactured and made and stuff to speed with. They waited for me with open arms, you know? And they got me a job up in the laboratory, B3, and I could make moonshine up there on the weekend. I'm making moonshine. I got me a separatory funnel up there and a filtering flask. I got it going on. I'm making moonshine. police is gone on the weekend. And then I worked in a butcher shop, and so we started making a pruno in the toxic waste bin, you know, because we got a drink. And they had a little guy there and scared to death. He was messing with the police, and they was bringing him in half pints, and sometimes they would knock the neck of the bottle off, and the glass would go in there. And, you know, we didn't care. We was drinking and using and whatsoever. And after I did 5 years on that life sentence, I got the jury was overturned in the decision of People versus Brock. That's my name, Luther Brock. And they returned me back to the streets. And my mother lived no further than from here to that next building down there from the jail. And before I get to my mother's, I had me some alcohol, some drugs, and a pistol. Well, I had got a letter from a guy in there, and all I knew about that was this letter was this guy was a white dude, and he was in 12-step fellowship. And in those days when I come up, if you wanted to marry somebody, you'd have to ask their daddy or their brother or something, you know. And he wrote me a letter. He wanted to marry my baby sister, Mona Lisa. Some of y'all know Mona Lisa, my baby sister. And so I got out and I went down there to San Jose, and this guy's sitting there, and I'm talking to him, and I'm high, and I'm asking him questions, and he would say what he said, and then he'd say, well, the answer's in the big book. And the answer's in a big book. And I said, well, whatever this big book is, it must be pretty powerful. You know, I didn't know. And he said, and there's a seat in these rooms for you. With that smile. Well, nobody telling me about my smile. They was really going to the other side of the street, because I was not smiling in those days, you know. And he invited me to these rooms. And one day, I had gotten busted and all that, you know, and said, you know what, I'm going to try these rooms out. And I came in, and I loved it. I came in, I started doing my steps, I made friends, I got me a sponsor. But I did something that it says not to do. In this, in the doctor's opinion, it says that we suggest entire abstinence. So I figured, well, I'm not shooting dope no more. Give me some alcohol, some pluck. Yeah, I went and got me some of that Akadama we used to drink in the Philippines. You know, some all these fine. I would drink on the weekends until one day I found myself laying in the floor, fixing myself in the neck with my pistol cocked, telling don't nobody move, because I didn't want to paralyze myself. And that's how I would get where I was, and I'm going to shoot dope again. I went back to prison, and when I was in prison, it was a bad time. They was fixing to kill this guy, Robert Alton Harris. He was the last guy to kill in California, and it wasn't no visits, wasn't no hot meals, wasn't no newspapers, wasn't no, you know, in the showers, and they had us in this big room, nine of us. You know, they were popping the rubber gloves. Y'all know what they're fixing to do. Yeah, everybody come on out, you know. And I got a letter from my brother, Milton. And in that letter was a piece of literature. And it said, sure beat sitting in the cell. It's a piece of AA literature. I said, wow. And I looked at that, and I came on out to recovery. Today, those other eight guys are dead, every single one of them. I watched and heard them die, and I knew who they was. And the last guy went to church, and then he still died in an attic. So I came back in the rooms of recovery on the 9th of February, 1990. And I came in, and I got to the recovery house, and was there, shoo, and sit down out there, and a man came out there. I said, well, I'm ready. He said, well, we gave your bed 10 days ago. You had a bed 10 days ago. I said, oh, I had been out 10 days. I had been up 10 days. And he came back out there later. He said, so didn't you hear me? I said, well, yeah, but I ain't going nowhere. You know, because I had already, the night before, came up to go into recovery. Fell out in a plate of gravy with my face in there. My sister Mona Lisa, come on, my big brother's here. I woke up, my niece Tina, her boyfriend was here with one of them 444 hoses. And I said, well, that car go fast? He said, yeah, take me back to San Francisco. I give him a $100 bill. We went in the fast lane He took me back to San Francisco, and I got me some alcohol, and I was drinking. I was trying to get up in the room to go fix the shit, and wouldn't nobody let me in. Everybody was gone and stuff. I tell this girl, here's $5, let me. And I went in, and the girl said, I know what you're doing in there. No, she didn't. I had went in that room, and I had shit on myself. I'm in the toilet, cleaning up my drawers. Oh, player, player, Luther. You know? I washed out my drawers in there. I said, no, you don't. And I came out, and I got me a ride back to recovery. And at that time, I said, well, you know what? I was here once. I'm not going to be back again. What do I need to do? And I dropped on my knees, and I asked God to relieve me of the obsession and the compulsion that drugs and alcohol would put on me. Please, on my knees. And 9 months later, I said, you go back? 9 months ago is what I wished for. Boy, I'm all right now. This is fine, man. Went and got me a job, was doing great. You know us, we get to work early and we leave late. You know what I mean? I was able to go to a meeting at noontime. I was taking care of developmentally disabled people. I was on parole and probation by this time. And they came to me one day and they said, you know, Luther, you're one of the best employees we've had in 10 years. Well, that's really saying something. All the people come through there taking care of people who are developmentally disabled. They said, well, we got to let you go, you know. I said, well, how come? They said, well, you didn't tell us you'd been in prison for murder. I said, okay. So I left, and about a week later, I came back with the head of the Developmental Disabilities, Department of Developmental Disabilities, Ms. Pecunier. Her husband was the head of the Adult Authority, California Adult Authority. Came back with her and the probation and the parole officer, and we sat down. And I pulled out my application, and I said, you see right here where I said my last job was on the State Department of Corrections? And they said, the reason you left, well, sentence was overturned. And they gave me my job back. And they tell people to be rigorously honest in them programs and stuff, and you don't know why they do that. And man, they promoted me, and next thing I know, I was what they call a QMRP, Qualified Mental Retardation Professional. I was supervisor. Psychologists, psychiatrists, and, you know, carry on. And then one day, here come my partner, Dave. Hey, David Lewis. He said, man, you know what? Guys in the penitentiary want to see you. I said, for what? He said, I got a meeting up there. Come up there, go to the meeting with me, man. Come up and, you know, be the speaker. So there we went. We went on up to San Quentin to the I'm not sure if it was Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics that morning, but I ended up going to both meetings. And when I got there, all them guys came from the lower yard. They got 3 yards in San Quentin, an up yard, and all the lifers came up because in the 5 years I was there, I was the only lifer that got his sentence overturned. Nobody went home. Matter of fact, they put Rose Justice and the other two people out of office in the Supreme Court when they overturned the decision in People versus Brock. And I'm up there, and the life of this company, well, man, Luther, what? Oh, man, we're so glad to see you. I'm in civilian clothes, so I'm not going to orientation. You know, we talking and we laughing, man, I'm hugging, and the police is looking out. These just white guys, Mexicans, black guys, gay guys, everybody got like, they up there, we talking. So it was quite an experience, and it was an experience because right before I left, I was up there in the upper yard, and so it's maybe 1,500 guys in a space like this. I mean, it ain't too much, you know, ain't nobody touching nobody. And it parked, and the guys started going, roof, roof, roof. Well, this is the sign from East Palo Alto, where, you know. And the thing parted, and in came my son, Luther Brock Jr. He's a PLR, Palo Alto Lowrider. And they would say, Clay's here, you know, my son. I walk in and they call me on the thing. They said, well, Brock, we're going to put your son in the cell with you. You know, I said, no, you ain't. I'm not going back in that cell. Now, we had just had a problem because it was an earthquake. And they let us out of the cells and we wasn't going back. So they were talking about calling the National Guard. They had dogs. They had, oh, no. And you going to put my son in there with me? Nah, ain't going to happen. And so they said, well, we'll put him next door. So I had 2 months to learn my son everything that I learned while I was there in state prison. And when he guy came and got me, and he took me to the big Sallyport doors, with, you know, the one in the movie go clang, you know. And he went, and old cop, he said, "Hey, Brock." I said, "Yeah, I'm getting ready to go out there." He said, "Your job be waiting for you when you get back." So I didn't came back now, and the lieutenant I'm working at the back gate with, he, sergeant, he's a lieutenant now. And he said, "Man, Brock, man, it's just such a wonderful experience." He said, "I'm on a classification minute. Come on back in and sit in classification with me, just like you're the police or you're a consul or something, you know?" And man, I went back there and sit in the classification committee, and everybody bought in. I told them, "Send him to the ranch. You know, I don't want nobody to go to maximum security. You know, send him, you know he's a good guy. Send him to the," you know, they laughing and joking, and then they holler, "Escort." So, you know, when they holler escort, they got a guy that's got life or the death penalty with the police behind him. You know, he's handcuffed. They got the machine gun following him throughout the prison, going from one place to another. And they bring the guy in to classification. And you know who was right there? Who was that? That old cop that took me to the gate. He looked over there and seen me. He said, "Rob, what you doing sitting over there?" I got up, put out my hand. I said, "How you like me now?" I said, he said, "Well, what do you," I said, "You know, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. The lieutenant asked me to sit here." He couldn't believe it. So I left there, and it was a new thing. And I went back to my job, and I told my job, I said, "You know what, I am going to go, I need a week to go think about something." And I went, and they said, "Take it off with pay." I took that week, and I came back, and they said, "Well," I said, "I need another week. Take it off with pay." So when I came back the third time, it was a little church down on the bottom of the hill. And I stopped at that church, and I went in there, and I got on my knees, and I said, "God, please help me make a decision. I need to make this decision." And I went back up to the top of the hill, and they was in a little group, and I said, "I'm going to be leaving. I was just, you know, they knew I had been to prison. I was just at the prison I had been in. I'm going to leave, and me and my friends are going to start a recovery program." They said, "All right, you've been a good guy." And I went to turn around and go back. I said, "Well, wait a minute." I said, "What?" And they gave me an envelope. I said, "What's in here?" And it was $10,000. I said, "What for?" They said, "This is called severance pay."
That's right.
I said, "I ain't never heard no shit like this in my life. They gonna give me $10,000. So I put that money in my pocket. By this time, I had my old Cadillac, 67 Coupe de Ville, had a fifth wheel in the back with a Rolls Royce, front on the back, and leather seats with LV in the middle. I'm riding, you know, and got in my Cadillac, went and got, and left, and went to do, start the recovery program. It's called Free at Last. That's in East Palo Alto, California. It's a huge, huge recovery program, with, you know, 80% of the people don't go back to prison and jail. A lot of, you know, addicts. And one day I get a call from my mother, because, like I told you, that lady introduced us to the program. And we go home, and so my whole family is in the program. My brother Milton had 32 years. My sister Mona Lisa has 31. I have 27. And my baby brother, my mother gives me a thing, and she said, "Well, call this number." I call it, and it's my brother's wife. And she said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, look, he's up in here in New York, in Harlem, and he done passed out, and they want to donate his eyes. He's dying." My mother said, "Here's the money. Here's the insurance thing. Go on to New York and see about him." And I go there, and I walk up in the hospital to see him, and the people's looking at me funny. And then I came in, I go in his room, and he's sitting up in the chair, and he's hollering, no. Somebody must have said something to him, because he had been in a coma. And they said, and the bell started going off to say his brother came here from California. He woke up, just like in the movies. He had been in a coma. You know, he weighed 117 pounds. He was on 125 milligrams of methadone. And his wife was living up underneath his bed. You can do this in New York. She's selling crack. And they done run all the people off that's coming to college. She's ride or die right there with him. And they find out I am his brother. I pick him up and I start taking him to Dallas. As I pick him up, we go there, you know, I bathe him off. Because, you know, I was working in a place where I did that. And the doctor said, look, if he get, they call it in and outer. If he get much as out as you put in, then we'll take him off dialysis. And so I started putting that cranberry juice in him. And one day he did not have to go to dialysis no more. And he's sitting on his bed and he said, I want to ask you something. I said, what? He said, where are you going every day at noon? You going to fix? So I tell him, I said, well, no, I'm going to a meeting in Narcotics Anonymous. He said, what? I said, well, I'm going to a meeting of AA. And he said, I thought you was in the Moonies or something. You mean you ain't? What do I have to do to stop using? And I told him, you got to call AAANA. And I came back the next day. There was a dude sitting there. He was smoking a cigarette. And I said, who are you? What you doing? He said, I'm from central office. I said, how you get here? He said, your brother called me. And my brother's been sober for 25 years now. Good man. Good man. I have a lot of other things to say. My time is getting short. I went out and found two of my kids. One of my daughters, I found her. We went to eat and she started crying. And I told her, I got to go. I love you. And she said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to a meeting up the street. You know, and I've been looking for her for about 22 years. She said, a meeting of what? I said, Narcotics Anonymous. She started crying again. I said, well, why? She said, you could have found me in the room. Daddy, I've been clean for 15 years. Yeah. Yeah. So I got one of my daughters back. I adopted her son. I went to adopt him, and they wasn't gone. They called me, and they said everything went right. My record came back, and the supervisor was there and said, nope, came to the house. I said, you got over 100 arrests. You think we're going to let you adopt somebody? I'm smiling. Why are you smiling? I said, I just adopted one of my grandsons 2 years ago. They looked at it. They said, I'll be damned. Adopted him, went back to the judge's thing. They said, well, what do you want to do? We got a picture. They're taking pictures. I said, I got a daughter I haven't found. So over 20 years ago, I got the Rolodex card I didn't save. They said, we ain't going to tell you what we is, but we tell one of her folks, one of her kids. And so I told one of my kids, she's a pharmacist up in Connecticut, and they got a call and said, Daddy, we found our other sister. I got 7 girls and 2 boys. And she sent me a picture. I said, what? She said, well, I'd like to see you. Can I bring my boyfriend? I said, yeah, you sent me a picture of her. Big old, a white boy with a big old head. She hiding behind his picture, you know. So they came on over to see me, you know. We had a party, and the guy said, I got an announcement. I said, what's that? He said, your daughter has got the best man she ever had. I said, oh, really? Why you say that? He said, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. We stood up and laughed, me and my brother, you know. Man, we've been in the program, we've been in the program. My daughter's sitting over there, and I said, well, yeah, you know, I've been here since the 9th of February, 1990. And my daughter said, what'd you say, Daddy? I said, I've been here the 9th of February, 1990. She said, Daddy, that's my birthday. So every year on my birthday, I get to celebrate with my baby girl. So recovery and life has been nice. I made a lot of money. I got a chance to retire early. I retired to take care of my mother. She was 95 years old. And she told me the best thing in life ever happened to her, all her kids got sober. So it was good. And 2 years ago, my brother was like my twin, 13 months. Went to the hospital and he didn't wake up. And I was devastated. I had been with him for several weeks, and we had been doing stuff. And we was over at a meeting, and one of his sponsors came up. He said, well, where you been? Man, I ain't seen you. He said, well, I've been going to different meetings. He said, how come? He said, I've been doing 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, my brother been doing 90 meetings. I'm like, what the fuck is going on with him? He knew something was going on, you know? And so I lost my brother, and I put on a 4-day thing for him to bury him, and a guy came up to me and said, man, you buried your brother like he was Jesus Christ. I didn't know how to bury nobody. These rooms taught me that. And while I was there at the funeral going out, one guy told me, say, man, you know what? He walked up to me. Say, my name is General John Adams. I said, well, he said, your brother sponsored me and nobody else would. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of brother I have. And I went home and I got my sisters and my kids with me. And I said, I just got diagnosed with cancer. They said, oh, my God. Milton had died in 9 years. And so I went to the treatment. And I went through, I got two major infections. I was in the hospital. It took everything from me. They had to put a tube in my Johnson. I didn't know guys had bladder infection. They had to put a tube in my arm because I don't have no vein. And I was on my back and I didn't let nobody in my house. Okay, because I felt very vulnerable. I've got PTSD. I had already come out here to Atlanta and my therapist told me that I was walking around a patrolling area. I built a big fence around my house with strobe lights. And that PTSD had jumped out at me. But you know what? Things started to get better. I got on my feet. And my friends came to see me, Aziz and my sponsee, Reggie. And they came on out to California. The hitters did. And then Muhammad came on out for the Black Panther 50-year thing. And the hitters came to see me, and it was wonderful. And I got on up, and then, bam, my knee went out. I got a new knee back on my back again. A little bit later, I fell down in front of the hospital. I had a protruding disc. My left side went out, and I just got a new girlfriend. They put me in the hospital. That girl came to see me every day. And when I got home, she's now my girlfriend. She's living at my house. Young girl, and I put a ring on her finger. She said, well, no, I know you ain't going to marry, baby. You just don't know. Oh, yeah, I'm definitely going to marry you, you know, because you're the one, and I wanted my next relationship to be my last. I got stuff going on with her, you know, and it's just the way it is. And I'm going to read this to her when I get home. First of all, the stuff that's going down on me, what I got, 5 minutes, Barry? Yep. The stuff that's going down on me ain't about her. It's about me. And when I came up, this is what they read in this big book. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems. Today when I'm disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of life unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, thing, place, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this one moment. Nothing, exactly nothing, happens in God's world by mistake till I can accept my alcoholism. I could not stay sober until I accept life completely on life terms. I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in this world as what needs to be changed in me and my attitude. And that's what I'm going to have to tell her when I get back, because she's seen me tell a guy, hey, you know what, man, but when he says something, I say, hey, check this out. I don't mind turning another cheek, but I ain't going to spread them. And next time you say something to me like that or to my sister or brother who's in the family, you know, some things a man got to do. And I had already done that. So I boom. So I'm going to close with this, you know, and just telling people what this program has meant to me, what you guys have meant to me, the people in this fellowship and the heavy hitters and all my friends out there, because you guys are my friends, black, white, gay, Catholic, Muslims, I don't care. And I'm going to read it at the end of the Keys of the Kingdom. It says, and I'm going to say that the last 27 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that's life. But I've also known a great deal of joy and a peace that is a handmaiden of inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of the fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives of newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experience, our mutual trust, our understanding and love, without strings and without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness, that awful ache, so deep in the heart of every alcoholic and addict that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and need never return again. Now there's a sense of belonging, of being wanted, of being needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a fit, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.